Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Well, when we get our basic civics education about the structure of the federal government, one of the things that we're taught is that the United States Supreme Court has the last word on the meaning of the Constitution. At the same time, Congress has broad control over the court and its power to review the work of lower courts. And certainly both Congress and the executive have made efforts to try to get around the court, to find venues to hear cases that are important to them, and to secure outcomes that they're looking for. And that, of course, leads some people to worry about the judicial independence of the U.S. Supreme Court. This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Jim Fander. He's professor of law at Northwestern University Law School. And among the things that he's interested in his academic work, is the role of the court and its relation to lower courts. And this is something that he explores in his book, One Supreme Court, the subtitle, Supremacy, Inferiority, and the Judicial Power of the United States. It's published by the Oxford University Press and is out now. And certainly, if you're interested, you can take a look at the book. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll try to talk about some of the things that he deals with in the book and perhaps also ask some more general kinds of questions about the court and about where we are now at the point where we're going to have a new justice, and that is certain to change things. And questions on that subject, I think, are welcome, and I know that he'll do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL or 9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. As I mentioned, our guest, Jim Fander, is professor of law at Northwestern University Law School, and folks here in Champaign-Urbana, I know, will recognize the name. He was professor of law here at the University of Illinois for a number of years. And Professor Fander, hi, how you doing?
I'm fine, David. It's good to hear your voice.
Good. Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. What I want to try to do here, because the book looks at this question, these questions, in great detail, and for people who want to pursue it in that sort of depth, they can certainly take a look at the book. And what I'm hoping is, though, that I'm grasping well enough the basic concern that you have and that we can talk about it in a way that those of us, including myself, who are not legal scholars, can grasp. So, and maybe the thing to start would be just for me to say, well, if you take out your copy of the Constitution and you open it up and you go to that section where it talks about the Supreme Court, what does it say about the court and the relationship of the U.S. Supreme Court to all of the other courts, all of the other judges all around the United States?
Well, it's written in very spare language, as you no doubt know, mm-hmm. and it doesn't answer these questions in great detail, and that makes the task of its interpretation quite a challenge. It's something that's challenged scholars and jurists for centuries now. But basically, the language of Article 3 declares that the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court, and in such inferior courts as Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. So it seems to require the existence of one Supreme Court, and it seems to make it discretionary with Congress whether to create lower federal courts or not. And it doesn't say much about the relationship of those courts other than that one shall be supreme and that the others shall be inferior. So the question that arises from the rather spare language of Article 3 of the Constitution is the extent to which Congress can reshape the judicial architecture, if you will, away from what has traditionally been seen as a kind of judicial pyramid with the Supreme Court sitting on top of the heap and a number of different kinds of lower courts below, whether Congress has power to restructure that judicial pyramid in ways. And in some ways, the most important question is whether Congress can place matters entirely beyond the Supreme Court of the United States and its power to exercise judicial review of the constitutionality of government action. Mm.
Well, before going on to that point, then just let me ask this question. Is it a matter of debate whether the U.S. Supreme Court has authority over state courts?
It is not, I think, a matter of debate that the Supreme Court of the United States has appellate jurisdiction, and that its appellate jurisdiction extends to decisions by the state courts that adjudicate questions of federal law. Mm-hmm. So if you have a question of federal law pending in a state court, that issue is subject to review today in the Supreme Court of the United States. Article 3 actually declares that the court shall have original jurisdiction in certain cases and shall have appellate jurisdiction in others. And most people agree, I think, today that that grant of appellate jurisdiction extends to state court decisions. What complicates that lesson or that conclusion is the next provision of the jurisdictional language of the Supreme Court, and that is the provision that says that the Supreme Court shall have such appellate jurisdiction subject to such exceptions and regulations as the Congress shall make. So the Constitution confers appellate jurisdiction, but it permits Congress, apparently, to fashion exceptions and regulations. And it's the exceptions and regulations clause that both judges and scholars have pointed to in arguing that Congress has broad control over the Supreme Court's appellate jurisdiction and can, if it chooses, pick out particular items that it doesn't want the Supreme Court to hear. Hmm. It's that provision that gives rise to what's called the court stripping or the jurisdiction stripping debate in federal jurisdiction and federal constitutional circles.
Well, here again, to make sure they understand this, and that actually seems pretty clear, that if the Congress has some legal question they want to have settled, then they have an idea of the outcome that they'd like to have. If they don't think that they would be likely to get that, or there'd be some question about whether they could get that at the Supreme Court, what you're saying is that what they can do is they can find some state court to hear it, and that would make it more likely that they'd get the outcome that they would be looking for.
It could make it more likely, but matters grow even more complicated. So if you imagine a hot-button issue of today, the constitutionality of the Pledge of Allegiance, for example, or the constitutionality of prayer in the schools. Suppose that Congress were to adopt a statute that simply curtailed the jurisdiction of both the lower federal courts and the Supreme Court of the United States. Many people think that that would mean that the state courts would have the final word on those constitutional issues, that the state courts would decide whether the Pledge of Allegiance was constitutional and whether prayer in the schools was permissible. And then the question would arise, to what extent are the state courts obligated to follow the decisional law of the Supreme Court in cases within the scope of that jurisdictional restriction? So, as you know, in general, state courts and lower federal courts are all bound to decide their cases in accordance with the precedents set by the Supreme Court of the United States. But what happens if Congress curtails the court's appellate jurisdiction? Does that mean that the lower courts are free to ignore the Supreme Court's precedents and decide for themselves, or do they remain bound by those precedents? In the case of the Pledge of Allegiance, there's no clear decision of the Supreme Court of the United States that courts would be free to apply or ignore. With respect to prayer in the schools, there is a fairly straightforward, on-point decision by the Supreme Court. So the state courts would face the question in that situation whether they were bound to follow that decision. And some of the recent statutes that Congress has considered go so far as to declare that the state courts will be immune or free to ignore the precedents of the Supreme Court with respect to the particular issues that Congress has identified. So it suggests that at least some state courts might take up the opportunity to ignore a Supreme Court decision and go a different direction. Mm. Other state courts might well fall in line and say, you know, we're still lower courts and we're still bound by what the Supreme Court says, whether there's a prospect of appellate review and reversal or not.
See, this is the part of this that I find both a little bit confusing and also surprising. And I suppose it goes back to the way that I was trying to introduce the whole topic, and that is this idea that I have, and I expect people have, is that, well, the Supreme Court is what it says. It is. It is the Supreme Court, and it is the job of the Supreme Court to be the final arbiter on constitutional questions. And it's not a power that anybody can usurp. But it sounds as if what you're saying is that, well, that's not exactly true, and that it is it is possible, and I guess I still don't quite understand how that could be, that some lower court could make a determination on a question of the Constitution and that the U.S. Supreme Court then could essentially not have anything to say about it.
Well, let me say that my own view is in accordance with yours, David, and that rightly understood, the Constitution in Article 3 does make the Supreme Court the final arbiter of the meaning of the Constitution. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it has to exercise appellate jurisdiction in every case, but it does mean that Congress has to respect the relationship of supremacy and inferiority that the Constitution imposes between the one court at the top of the heap and all the other lower courts. So my book is an attempt really to provide a technical legal explanation for what we might all assume is the fundamental civics lesson of the Constitution, and that is three branches of government: the Congress legislates, the President executes, and the Supreme Court and the lower courts adjudicate claims. All of these branches of government are sort of constitutionally guaranteed, and one cannot attack the other. That's the idea of checks and balances and so forth. So I think the basic civics takeaway is, as it turns out, accurate. And the only thing that makes, in some ways, the book interesting is that many, many people over the course of the history of this country and many scholars in my field of federal jurisdiction don't view it that way. Hmm. They view the combination of something called the Madisonian Compromise, which allows Congress to decide whether or not to create lower federal courts if it chooses, or leave matters to state courts if it chooses. That, coupled with the Exceptions and Regulations Clause, has been seen in conventional jurisdictional discourse as giving Congress a great deal of control. And some people think, in fact, that it's a good thing. One of the arguments in favor of congressional control is that it provides a fundamental democratic underpinning to everything that the Supreme Court does, so that the Supreme Court doesn't have to act on the basis of its own interpretation of the Constitution when it exercises judicial review. Instead, it can point to an act of Congress and say, see, the people of the United States and their elected representatives have authorized us to act. And it's only when Congress exercises that power in a way that is, in some sense, antagonistic to the Supreme Court, as in the case, for example, of the Guantanamo Bay military commissions, that the Supreme Court has to push back.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Jim Fander. He's professor of law at Northwestern University School of Law, where he teaches federal courts, civil procedure, and constitutional law, and is the author of the book One Supreme Court: Supremacy, Inferiority, and the Judicial Power of the United States, published by the Oxford University Press. And that's where you will find a more in-depth discussion of these very issues that we're talking about here. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller here, someone in Morris. So we'll go right there, line 4. This is our toll-free line. Hello?
Yes, good morning. Good discussion. The justices of the country, they all have a law they have to abide by. And you can't, you got to be impartial. You can't be one side or the other, and why, whenever it seems like we change, whether it be a Democrat in office or a Republican in office, and they make a big deal about how he or she might vote, you know, not knowing, you know, they're assuming, you know, all this stuff that, you know, let's be fair and honest by picking these people. And I mean, because I honestly think if you're good enough to be in that position in the first place, you're going to make sound sound judgments, because you're looking at people's lives hanging in the balance or issues that could affect each one of us individuals in a big way. My comment, I guess, is just, you know, I wish we could take the labels off of Democrats and Republicans and independents and so forth, and just go by what this person, he or she, is qualified for, because that seems to be the reason why this country is in such turmoil in the first place. We got one side pitting the other side, and it's never about how qualified or the issues that they have done in the past. Don't you think? I mean, like the abortion issue. They want to make a big deal about abortion or non-abortion, and you know, I'm not a religious person. I mean, I believe in God and all that, but again, it goes back to Christmas, and you know, now because because one side complains, the other side constantly, you can't have Christmas trees, you can't have Santa Claus, you can't have this and that. You know, it's just, it's too many, it just seems because, you know, it's either the left against the right or the right against the left, and it's enough already. Let's make sound judgments that, you know, God heaven forbid any of us has to go in front of a court someday, you know, and our life's in a judge and a jury's hands. Once you have to go through that, I think it's a scary process, and I think people need to start waking up and paying attention more to this than anything else, and I'll get off. Thanks.
Well, I appreciate the comments. It's been a struggle to try to identify qualifications for the Supreme Court justices. At present, the justices all have lower court judicial experience, which is quite unusual, and the nominee, Judge Sotomayor from the Second Circuit, also has Second Circuit judicial experience. In some ways, that may make the candidate a bit more judicious. But in other ways, it may make the candidate somewhat more predictable because from the president's perspective, these now judges, but someday to be justices, assuming confirmation, have voted on a number of issues over time. And one can tell a great deal about the way one approaches, a judge approaches legal issues by looking at the record of votes and the opinions that the judge has crafted. So it's interesting in some ways that the drive towards the appointment of lower court judges may coincide with the desire of the president to have a somewhat more predictable outcome in the selection of justices. That said, I think it's certainly true that that you're quite right, that a good many issues come before the Supreme Court that are not politically charged. And on those issues, we're all well served as a country if the justices are impartial and if they are good lawyers. The task of judging is not an easy one, and there are better and worse ways to go about it. And there are judges who come to the bench and really make a contribution in certain areas of the law that may have nothing to do, for example, with the hot-button political issues of the day. For example, Chief Justice Rehnquist was well known for his knowledge of Western water law, and on those issues he was quite influential, even if other justices might disagree with him about the politics. In some ways, it's interesting to think about trying to depoliticize the court by bringing more issues to it. And there are some proposals working their way around various think tanks and so forth that would expand the jurisdiction of the court with a view towards bringing more apolitical matters before it, where it could just be a court and less, in some ways, a third political branch of government. But it is also true that the decisions of the justices are to some degree or another, and it varies with justice and it varies from case to case, informed by their own background, their own worldview, their political vision, their sense of what is good for the country. And those are matters that one can't really reason to as a matter of legal principle, but matters that are informed by politics. And since there are so few other ways that the people of this country can exercise political control over the Supreme Court, it is in some way understandable that so much energy is devoted to the confirmation process and to the nomination process that the president goes through before the confirmation process unfolds. Because think about it, the courts are independent, the judges have life tenure, their salaries can't be cut. If my thesis in the book is correct, there are limits on the extent to which Congress can curtail their jurisdiction. And if all those avenues of political control are unavailable, the main avenue remaining is the confirmation fight. And so I think that is really, in some sense, what helps to explain why these battles grow so contentious.
All right, let's talk with another caller here where we are, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. Have you looked at this recent, I believe it was taken out of the bill, but this is, again, about Guantanamo and detainee practices, but the photograph release was itemized as something that was going to be the prohibition of the release of those. So the Congress was going to say that no matter what a court decides, prior or after precedent or otherwise, that those would not be released. It seems to me that's an awful precedent to set, because if national security, winning the war in Afghanistan, were such, then somebody could say, well, why don't we just suppress all of the civilian victims, the deaths of civilians, because that's hurting the war effort, too. So I don't know if you've followed that But it, well, I believe it was taken out. Mm-hmm. That's maybe the other reason why the Republicans say they're voting against it today, besides the IMF funding, which is probably going to help more banks in the U.S. than anywhere else anyway. But that's another story. Have you thought about that? Because it seems to me it's ripped out of the headline sort of example of the Congress saying no matter what the court decides in this ACLU case, we're going to prohibit the release of the photographs, which have already been released, and the speculation about what's in them anyway is probably worse than otherwise. So I will hang up and listen because there's a lot of ambient noise where I am here. Right. Thanks.
Thank you. I haven't followed the specifics of the legislation, but in general, Congress has the right to regulate prospectively, and it can change the rules of the game if it chooses to within constitutional limits. So while we might not embrace the notion that Congress is going to reach into the situation of a case that's pending and decide a legal issue, if it identifies a legal issue in the course of a pending dispute and chooses to address that issue with legislation, so long as it acts without violating any constitutional restrictions, it seemingly would have the freedom to do so. There are some limits on the ability of Congress to actually dictate results to judicial in judicial proceedings, and there are certainly limits on the ability of Congress, once a court has finally resolved an issue, to reopen that issue and direct the court to take another look. But as long as the issue remains pending in the courts, the general rule permits Congress to act so long as it doesn't violate a constitutional restriction. So it may just be a matter of policy, should Congress take this issue up. It's a little hard for me to identify the constitutional issue that would be at stake in this sort of situation. I suppose the public's right to know or something of that nature, but presumably in a balance of that against the national security interests that Congress would articulate, it might be hard to identify the constitutional limit.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Jim Fander. He's professor of law at Northwestern University Law School. For a number of years here, he taught University of Illinois at our law school. He's interested in his work as an academic and the role of the Supreme Court and its relationship to lower courts. And this is something that he discusses in his recent book, One Supreme Court, Supremacy, Inferiority, and the Judicial Power of the United States, published by the Oxford University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We've talked a little bit about one kind of concern, that is that that Congress could, by maneuvering cases that have to do with constitutional issues, get them heard by a state court and perhaps get the kind of outcome. Of course, there's never any guarantee, but maybe get the kind of outcome that they are interested in that they might not get if the Supreme Court was hearing it. There's something else here that also you deal with in the book, and that is that, say, if you're interested, if there's a particular legal matter that has to be dealt with, you might, in a sense, create a special court like those that the Bush administration was talking about creating to hear cases of people who were detained as suspected terrorists at Guantanamo, that seemed to be outside, that would be, in a sense, outside of the system here that has to do with federal court, Supreme Court, state court. Is there, do you think that somehow there has been some kind of growing tendency to try to get, in a sense, to get around the Supreme Court by having somebody else, some other kind of judge in some other kind of court, hear your case? Is that something that's we're starting to see more of?
I don't know that we're seeing more of it. There has been a tradition in this country of relying on what are called non-Article III tribunals to adjudicate matters that the Article III courts could just as easily handle themselves. And in some ways, the rise of the administrative state has a lot of explanatory power here, so that Social Security matters are questions of federal law that might have been resolved by federal courts, but these are assigned to administrative law judges subject to review within the Social Security Administration, and then finally to further review in the federal court system. The same is true of adjudications respecting the rights of immigrants, those seeking naturalization, those seeking entry into the country, those seeking to avoid deportation or removal from the country. Many of those issues are disposed of in the first instance by immigration judges and the Bureau of Immigration Appeals, and then finally come to the Article III courts. I think the number of Article III judges is really quite limited. There are only about 1,000 of them in the country. There are more administrative law judges in the Social Security Administration than all the Article III federal judges combined, including the Article III judges at all levels of the federal government, supreme, intermediate, and federal district court judges. And in some ways, it's just a concession to the necessity to do a lot of judicial business in this country and a desire to keep the Article III judiciary relatively small, relatively, for want of a better word, elite, and attractive to both litigants and to able judges who might want to serve in that capacity. So there are a number of non-Article III decision makers, but usually when Congress creates these non-Article III decision makers or tribunals, it routes the review of their decisions through the Article III judiciary. And so there are questions about whether Congress has the power to rely on these tribunals in the first instance and to what extent Congress could place their decisions entirely beyond the oversight of the Article III judicial establishment. And one good example, I think, as you point out, David, of a situation where Congress attempted to do that to some extent, but the Bush administration attempted to do it to an even greater extent, was in the case of Guantanamo Bay. Mm-hmm. The original presidential military order in that case shortly after 9/11 created military commissions to try claims of unlawful combat that were to be preferred against anyone caught or captured in the war on terror. And so instead of trying these individuals as they had been previously tried in the regular federal judiciary in the United States, the idea was to create specialized military commissions to hold those trials in Guantanamo Bay, subject to very different rules for the admission of evidence and so forth. And perhaps resulting in punishment, including the death penalty, for the commission of acts of illegal combat. And it was that decision by the Bush administration to create this alternative set of tribunals and to deliberately set that set of tribunals apart from the Article III judiciary that led to the well-known decision from last summer in the Boumediene case, in which the Supreme Court finally declared that the Bush administration and then ultimately Congress had gone too far in trying to place these tribunals beyond the reach of the Supreme Court and the lower federal courts.
We have another caller to talk with. In fact, a couple of them. And we'll go next to someone in Savoy on our line one.
Hello. Good morning.
Yes.
Apparently there is no mandate, constitutional mandate, requiring Supreme Court justices to be from the legal profession. However, almost exclusively, people with strong legal backgrounds are selected, whereas it seems to me that at that level, settled law is pretty much, you know, already taken care of in the lower courts, and a good historian or a constitutional or political historian might be able to contribute more balance and, you know, less legalese in making decisions. What do you think?
I think you're quite right on the first point. That is, there's nothing in the Constitution that requires the justices to be members of the bar drawn from the legal profession. There's another interesting omission. Members of Congress are required to be citizens of the United States, as is the president, but the Supreme Court justices are not required to be citizens of the United States, which may reveal an interesting feature of about what the framers thought the judges of the Supreme Court were going to do. They were going to apply the law. They were not going to make the law. So it was perhaps less essential that that they be natural-born citizens or of the United States. So there are those two interesting gaps. I wonder if it is the professional diversity that would contribute more to the Supreme Court, or other forms of diversity operating within the boundaries of the legal profession. I think you're quite right that a good historian, a good political scientist, could well play a contributing role, a productive role on the Supreme Court. It may take that person a little bit longer to find his or her voice as a justice of the Supreme Court. depending on which person one were to choose. And so when people talk about professional diversity, sometimes they think less about the disciplinary training than the life experience of the candidate. For example, Chief Justice Earl Warren was the governor of the state of California before he became Chief Justice, and hadn't, as far as I can recall, served as a judge before that day. There was a time when justices of the Supreme Court were more likely to be drawn from the political ranks rather than from the judicial ranks. So you think about Justice Jackson coming from the Attorney General's position under FDR. You think about Justice Black, for example, coming from the Senate Majority Leader's position with the Democratic Party under the Roosevelt administration. Those kinds of professional diversity and experiences, political experiences, were for many years thought to be important in the nominees selected by the president to serve on the Supreme Court. And in recent years, this turn has been towards the established judge. And so if one were to identify needed diversity, it might be to move away from judicial experience and into some other form of experience as a qualifying consideration for membership on that panel.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And then we'll continue and talk next with someone in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
My question has to do with Vice President Cheney and any constitutional kind of irregularities or things that went on the way he kind of seemed to take over different powers that were unprecedented. Most recently, I heard Seymour Hersh talking about an article he's working on where there was a secret military operation, supposedly, that answered just to Cheney. And I just wonder, aren't there constitutional issues in there, and will they be discussed over time? Will it take a long time to figure out what those are?
Well, I think it's fair to say that Vice President Cheney and others in the vice presidential office had a very capacious view of presidential authority. And understood that when the Constitution declares that the executive power shall be vested in the President of the United States, that a great deal of power is transferred by virtue of that provision, and that the President, as a result, is free to act, especially in the area of national security and foreign relations, free from congressional oversight to some extent, and free from the restrictive features of statutes that were already on the books. I think that's quite a controversial position, both historically and in terms of current understandings. But the question is, what exactly is the role of the vice president? And I think that question may be answered by reference to a question simply of delegation. You first have to define the power of the president of the United States and the extent to which that president, that person, is subjected to the control of statutes, and certainly there are important restrictions imposed on the office of the president and other aspects of the executive branch of the government by acts of Congress. So once you've defined the power of the president, then you can ask yourself the question, does the vice president have any freestanding authority outside the presidential framework? And my answer to that would be no. So to defend anything that Vice President Cheney did, one would have to point to some form of delegation, some sort of authorization that he received from the president. One presumes that Vice President Cheney, if he were chatting, would defend his actions as all presidentially approved. And if that's true, then it's really not a question so much of vice presidential authority, but a question of presidential authority.
That's a great answer. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's the number for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And our guest this morning is Jim Fander. He is professor of law at Northwestern University School of Law. Well, I was hoping that you we already have gotten into the subject, and that's not surprising, as I'm sure a lot of people are thinking about the fact that here now this summer we're going to have hearings for a new member of the Supreme Court. Justice Souter announced some time back that he was going to retire, and that we know that the Obama administration has nominated Sonia Sotomayor to take his place. And we will have hearings starting on July 13th. Just to start, would you say a couple things about David Souter and how the sort of role that he's taken on the court?
Justice Souter is in some ways quite similar, I think, to the ideal justice that one of the callers identified, a justice who's less interested in the politics and more interested in getting the law right. I had a great admiration for Justice Souter because I had followed his work as a Supreme Court judge with the New Hampshire Supreme Court before he was appointed first to the federal court in that part of the world, and eventually, I think, very briefly to the First Circuit, although I don't think he served there for very long before he was elevated to the Supreme Court. And Justice Souter always cares about getting the law right, especially the law of legal process. And as a proceduralist, a guy who teaches civil procedure and other kinds of judicial practice courses, I have an abiding admiration for the judges who care a great deal about getting those aspects of the law right. Justice Souter was very concerned with those features of law, and he was a very careful and thoughtful judge. He was very well read, read deeply on the cases that he was called upon to decide, and read deeply in other aspects of history. He was quite, I think, quite an able guy for all his vaunted eccentricities that have been much ballyhooed in the press. I think on a personal level and as an individual member of a 9-person bench, he had a great deal to contribute.
Yeah. Obviously, one doesn't know when someone joins the court. You can look at what they have said and done previously, but one really never knows how they will behave once they become a member of the Supreme Court. So making predictions here is maybe a little hazardous. But let us assume that Sonia Sotomayor is confirmed and she joins the court, and at least for the moment, nothing else changes. How likely do you think it is that her addition to the court is going to be significant and would be likely to end up pushing the court one direction or another, or having decisions that would be very different than what we had gotten before?
Well, that's a good question, and Justice Souter's case provides a nice illustration. He was appointed by the first President Bush, if I recall correctly the timing. Shortly after he joined the court, they faced the question of whether to overturn the Roe versus Wade decision or whether to preserve it, and he joined a 3-justice majority or plurality with Justice Kennedy and Justice O'Connor to fashion a kind of defense of the Roe regime on stare decisis grounds, and that's been the sort of unsettled compromise that has remained at the Supreme Court, at least on the abortion issue, ever since. Some people were surprised by Justice Souter's vote in that case. Others said that they could tell that he would be not a particular opponent of Roe based on what he had done previously. But to some, at least, it was a surprising vote. So you're quite right, David, I think, to say that justices are not entirely predictable. There's a debate, really, about whether presidents can really get what they want by selecting a justice. Justice, if she were confirmed, Sotomayor, would fill a position that is occupied today by a person seen as on the left side of the spectrum at the Supreme Court. So one's initial thought is that that she wouldn't create a dramatic change in the lineup if President Obama were to appoint one of the members of the current court that occupies what is traditionally seen as the right-hand side of the spectrum. Then one might predict more changes more quickly. In some ways, that will make it easier, I suppose, for the Senate to confirm Sonia Sotomayor to this position. And it would be if a greater change in the balance of the court were in the offing because she were being chosen to replace a different justice, then there might be a stronger sense of opposition on the part of those on the right. Mm-hmm. So there's that question, just a question sort of counting noses and how do you predict Justice Sotomayor will line up with the others? That, I think, is a little unpredictable. But again, we have a long collection, 10 years almost, of Second Circuit judicial decisions that Justice Sotomayor will have written on her way into that position that others can read and evaluate and try to assess in thinking about how she will play that role. My own sense is that that those who say that every justice changes the court have it just exactly right. because they're all human beings and they work very closely together. And the presence of an additional woman will make a change in incalculable ways. The presence of the first Hispanic justice will make an important difference. Even if that doesn't show up in the terms of any specific vote or any specific opinion. You know, the court gets its picture taken again whenever a justice joins, and that's, I think, a recognition of the way a new justice reshapes the landscape.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Jim Fander. He's professor of law at Northwestern University. And we're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Champaign. It's line number one. Hello.
What is your feeling about the lifetime appointment of a justice?
Well, that's a very good question. It would take, obviously, a constitutional amendment to change that. There are some proposals, I think, of dubious constitutionality that would try to impose term limits on the justices by encouraging them with varying degrees of carrots and sticks to step off after a period of service. Many, as you know, many of the constitutional courts in the European community and in the newly emerging democracies in the East have constitutional courts with justices who enjoy tenure protections, but those terms in office may last for only 9 years or so, depending on the court and its structure. Many people have argued for an 18-year term for the justices of the Supreme Court, and that would give every president two appointments. So once you instituted this program, it would ensure that every 2 years someone would leave the court and a new justice would join the court. I frankly think that the 18-year term is a pretty good idea. I think that there it's unlikely that that it would affect the independence, the impartiality of the justices of the Supreme Court sufficiently to pose an institutional threat to the court. On the other hand, I think it would have some good effects. I think it would to some extent ensure that the appointment process follows the election of presidents. At present, justices tend to step off the court in a way that facilitates the selection of their successors by a president of their own liking. And that's not necessarily a good thing. It leads to some entrenchment. One of the things that has kept the Supreme Court vital, notwithstanding life tenure, is the changing makeup of the court and the changes in the presidential appointing power that that has an inevitable impact on the selection process. Yeah. And so to regularize that, I think, would be helpful.
Well, I also think in terms of raising the diversity of the court, hopefully, you know.
It could.
Wonderful to see a woman, and I think there ought to be more. But the next issue is in terms of even our Congress, in terms of limitations, you know. I mean, you look at these people on television, even though I'm retired, I look at these people and I think, boy, a lot of these people are pretty old, you know. So whether we should have term limits in terms of on our Congress.
Well, that's a point. The nice thing about the 18-year term is in some ways it would take some of the pressure off the president to find the youngest person possible to do the job. And it would, instead of having to appoint someone in their 40s or early 50s who can, you know, make a contribution in the language of the presidential appointing statement for several years to come, you could appoint somebody who was 60. They could serve 15 or 20 years, perhaps in good health and make their contribution. It's unclear to me, after you've been on the court for 15 or 20 years, what new theories or new modes of constitutional interpretation you're likely to bring to that institution. So it may be the case that it would have a number of happy results.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We're at a point here now where let us say that President Obama is reelected and so he serves two terms, that he may be in a position more than any president in some time to have a very significant impact on the court and its future, as we have at least a couple of members who you'd think, well, might be of retirement age. The oldest is John Paul Stevens. He's 89. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 76 and I think has had some health problems in recent years, although now she seems to be doing just fine. And Anthony Kennedy is 72. So if you would think, well, maybe the oldest might be likely to retire, it's not impossible to imagine that President Obama might have the chance to name maybe two more justices during the time that he's president. Am I right in thinking that indeed he would be in this position to have a really profound influence on what the court is going to be like for some time to come?
Well, I think if he does get three or four appointments, that would you would certainly be correct that he would have shaped the court for some time to come. But again, one has to think about the spectrum that the retiring justice occupies in thinking about the transformative quality of an Obama selection. And so many people characterize Justice John Paul Stevens as the most liberal person on the court today. He resists that characterization and argues that he's the same guy he always was. But if you think of him in those terms, then replacing him with an Obama appointee would not necessarily alter the character of the court, except in the more subtle ways that we discussed around the Sotomayor nomination. The same would be true of a replacement of Justice Ginsburg, but it is also true that that younger people coming to the court who would be acceptable to an Obama judicial selection screening process are likely to be in some ways very different from the folks that are currently occupying those seats, especially Justices Stevens, Ginsburg, and Kennedy. Mm.
I suppose it sounds what you're saying though is that the only way that he could really profoundly influence the balance of the court would be if, for example, he had the opportunity to replace Mr. Roberts, Mr. Scalia, or Mr. Thomas.
Right. And so that's the transformation you see after the New Deal, for example. FDR's unbroken string of presidential successes enabled him to appoint every member of the Supreme Court. And it was at that point that the court's decisions turned dramatically in the direction of finding that legislation previously suspect was now permissible. So
As soon as the announcement was made that there would be – that one of the justices would be retiring and that the Obama administration would be naming someone, it didn't take long before both supporters and opponents geared up, and we know that this – like as we have seen the past few times, it's likely to be pretty bruising. Has the – I'm assuming that if you go back far enough that the appointment of justices was not quite as politicized. I mean, I suppose it's always been a matter of politics, but has it always been as politicized as, let us say, over the last, 50 years or so?
Well, I like to answer questions like that by asking myself about the experience of the early republic. And when George Washington was nominating justices of the Supreme Court, they were confirmed in a single day. So it's changed a great deal since then. It was only in the last century, in the 20th century, that nominees began to make the trek to Capitol Hill to face the Senate Judiciary Committee and confirmation hearings. Before then, it was thought inappropriate for the prospective justices to talk at all about their views or about their judicial philosophy and the like, and it was thought to be inappropriate for the Senate to sound them out on those issues. Again, that was a time when it was thought that the law was the law and the judges were just the sort of neutral, disembodied voice of the law rather than political actors in a political process who are shaping the law as well as simply announcing decisions under it. And so today we have a world in which, at least for as long as any of us can remember, justices have dutifully made their trip to the Senate to face the confirmation process. But I'm not sure this one will be quite as bruising as some have been. I haven't followed it perhaps as closely as some, but I haven't heard a lot of senators announce that they are dead set against this confirmation and aim to go after this nominee during the confirmation process. One of the things that happens around confirmations is that interest groups use them as an opportunity to organize and raise money. And so you will always hear interest group chatter around a proposed nominee to the Supreme Court. But will you get political pushback from the opposing members of the president's president's party, and I'm not sure how much of that will develop this time.
Something that we I'm sure we could spend an entire hour talking about it, and we only have a couple of minutes left, maybe you can say something, is the difference between this notion that we have of the court as being somehow aloof and detached and not influenced by politics and not influenced by public opinion and reality, which is that, in fact, there's really no way that the court cannot be influenced by politics or public opinion, and justices cannot help having some kind of inclination or opinion or ideology that they bring to the way that they read the law. No one could be so detached that they wouldn't do that. But I suppose it's how do we think about the sort of those two things, that is the ideal on the one hand and what is the reality, and is it possible to actually steer some middle course?
Well, there is something lawyerly about the task at hand, and it can be done either better or worse. There are some problems that crop up in the Supreme Court that yield themselves to traditional legal sorts of argumentation and solutions. But many, many of the problems are quite difficult. They've produced divisions in the lower federal courts, and that's why they've fetched up on the docket of the Supreme Court. And as to those issues, the law does not speak clearly. And it is inevitable, as you say, David, that values, political outlook, and other kinds of considerations are going to inform the way the justices approach those problems. That's not to say that what they do is entirely political, because I think the process is quite different. The way they think about their work is quite different from the way legislators think about their own work. So it hasn't become entirely a political process, but I think we can all agree that it's informed by values and outlook, yeah, and just the way that you characterized it. And I think we're always frustrated when we think that the Supreme Court has just given in to the political current of the day and has given up its task of articulating legal rules as opposed to political rules. But I think we haven't entirely given way to that more politicized view of the court.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Jim Fander. He's professor of law at Northwestern University Law School. His book is One Supreme Court, Supremacy, Inferiority, and the Judicial Power of the U.S., as published by the Oxford University Press. Jim, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, David.